I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to Countercurrents Radio. So we've had a tumultuous past couple of weeks, and that has led us to be a little bit behind in this episode and the previous episode of our weekly show. But by the end of this week, we should be back to doing shows every Friday. I want to begin with some thank yous to donors, and specifically I want to thank donors who have sent little notes along, and I'm going to read these notes and just give you all out there in the audience a sense of the kind of supporters we have and the kind of support we're getting. I think it's good to hear, and I think Mike and John will appreciate hearing this as well. So I'm just going to run through this. We received $5 from Christopher. Thanks for all your work, he says. $50 from Joe. What's happening is something long planned and well orchestrated. I wish I could contribute more. $15 from a friend who writes, my doctors and surgeons take it all, basically. Otherwise, it would be more. $100 from James. All the best. Hope you can stay online. $100 from Daryl. Thank you for your work. $50 from Ray. Keep the platform going. $100 from William. Keep up the good work. $50 from John. Keep up the good work. Countercurrents is at the vanguard of an intellectual revolution which will endure. $30 from Scipio. $100 from a Turkish reader who writes, Countercurrents is the immutable hub of reason and spirit around which the wheel of modernity will soon turn. Thank you all for what you do. Wish I could do more. You all sure as hell deserve it. That was very interesting. That was an interesting surprise. $250 from Tim. Although I've been shifting my financial support to Europe lately, I'll still be donating to Countercurrents as it's still a foundational pillar of our struggle. $25 with this note. Hey, Greg, I don't have a lot of money to give, but I hope this helps keep the site up. $25 from another person who writes, and this is one of the more unusual letters, and I'm going to pause here and there to skip over stuff, but I'll give you the flavor of it. I am a strong, ankh-wearing black woman, and I love you guys. This PC white genocide nonsense is bullshit. Coming to your website is like a drink of cool water on a sweltering day. I am against Nazism and eugenics, against black pride and black power, and against white genocide. Sorry for this shitstorm you're living through. We support you. We support white identity politics, just like we support black identity politics. There's a place for all of it. But we need to try and make peace and build bridges, not foment war like Antifa is doing. A world of independent groups of Europeans, Africans, and Asians working together and learning from each other is possible. And in that world, there's a place for people like me. In that world, people feel comfortable with who they are, so they can tolerate difference and celebrate non-physical similarities. In a world at war, I cannot exist. Namaste and best of luck. Please put me on your mailing list and let me know where I can find further materials from you. So I found that quite surprising and encouraging, actually.
That's great.
$25 with this note. Thank you for your work. You are a true gentleman. I have always admired your intelligence and dedication, and you have a sense of humor, too. A lot of these are addressed to me personally because they're responding to pieces that I put up with my byline that are raising funds. So, but some of them are addressed to all of us.
Are some of these with your new Patreon account, or are these exclusively Countercurrents donations?
They're Countercurrents donations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
$10. Too little, but genuinely all I can do just now. Stay strong. Your voice and your work is essential for all of us. $100. Such adversity is all to the good. First, it indicates the Jews are beginning to feel the heat. Second, the more the Jews and their government corporate hirelings exclude us from cyberspace, the more active we will become in real space. And that ultimately is where we are going to liquidate them. Good luck with your debate with Vox. $40. We shall persevere. $1,200. Please continue working for this thing of ours. $25. Greg, God bless you and your team for what you do. Our message needs to get to our people, and you're an essential part of that platform. Thank you for your courage and commitment to our people. Sic semper tyrannis. $50. Dear Greg, thank you. Today feels like a Winston Smith day. Above is a small donation. I want to thank Guillaume du Rocher, whose writings and thoughts I have usually much admired. I am also appreciative of you, Spencer Quinn, and others. Guillaume may be keeping a low profile now in his country, but please express my admiration for his work on my behalf if time allows. All the best. $100. Keep up the good work. You provoke serious thought, and I believe in your cause, which is now my cause. $50 from a Chinese supporter. My latest response to your donation call and expression of my support. Please stand tall and keep fighting in this time of great hardship and challenge. $25. It's not much, but I hope it helps. I bought a couple of your books from Amazon, too. I had sent you a draft of my book. Hopefully, when the storm is over, you can take a look. Yes, we will take a look. I apologize. I think I know who this is. Take care and long live our beloved white race. $300 from a poor graduate student. In my opinion, this website is unparalleled. $50. This donation is not an explicit endorsement of the site's philosophic dispositions, but against political and corporate censorship. $100 from NZ. I appreciate your content and apologize that it took a crisis to spur me to act. Good luck from NZ. $30. It is essential that you survive. $50. Thanks for the high quality content. I wish I could give more. Best of luck. $100. Hi, Greg. I'm not a white nationalist. I'm not even really right-wing, but I love Countercurrents. It's easily one of the most fascinating sites on the internet, and it is an essential voice in these insane times. I've been reading the site since 2012, so I've mooched a lot of free content off you, but I've never donated to you before because while I enjoyed your site, for a long time I considered you a likely enemy. I emphatically no longer feel that way. So much of what Countercurrents has predicted has come dramatically to pass and is only intensifying by the week that I have been forced to drastically reconsider my views about you and your movement. The establishment really is waging an increasingly open war against white people. At this point, that's just self-evident. In 2002, I thought you were nuts, but damn man, you were right. I have noticed how well you've comported yourself through various controversies, especially during your recent contretemps with Daniel Freeberg. You are obviously a good and principled man, and you have consistently shown remarkable courage and integrity in your work. I respect you, and I trust you. You certainly deserve to make a living doing what you do. So now I'm going to make up for at least for a tiny bit of my years of mooching by sending you $100. And it goes on in this vein. Oh, I also want you to know that I've shared your site with quite a few people who would never have come across it on their own. They're not white nationalists either, but they keep reading. So that was very flattering. Oh, there's more. This is a long one. I think Countercurrents is perhaps the only white nationalist site that is actively enlarging not just the numbers of your movement, but the spectrum of temperaments that increasingly take that movement seriously. Please keep up the excellent work. $10. Greg, sorry this has happened. Perhaps it was inevitable, but it's a gut punch nonetheless. I truly hope the organizers of Unite the Right learned valuable lessons from this debacle. Remember that no matter how bleak things look at the moment, you're never alone. Take care. Well, we're almost done here. $50. I've come across your writings a few times, but this isn't a site that I regularly browsed. However, these actions from the left are unacceptable. Keep up the good fight and expect more followers. $20. Keep up the fight, Greg. Godspeed. I wish I could donate much more. $75. Best of luck, Greg and Confederates. And finally, $20. I love your website. It has introduced me to so many ideas, and I want to thank you for that. I want to become a recurring donor, but this is all I can give at the moment. Keep fighting. So this is all very flattering and encouraging. And thank you. Thank you all for your tremendously generous support and also for these kind words, because encouraging words really do help with morale. I was reading Wilmot Robertson's The Ethno-State, and he has a chapter on morale. And he says, imagine a football team where the members are never praised for any of the things that they do. And in fact, they're constantly hectored and blamed, not only for their failings, but for the failings of everybody else. Do you think when they take the field, they're going to give it their all? Obviously not. And of course, the analogy applies to peoples and nations as well. And he was talking about the fact that we live in this poisonous atmosphere where whites are constantly under attack and how that is going to cause us to live poorly, make poor decisions, have bad lives, have bad societies. But it also applies to small microcosms like Countercurrents too. So kind words are really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, especially right now. it's, you know, given all the flack we're taking, it's good to hear messages from people who really appreciate what they're doing and, you know, like I said last time, who are actually willing to hand over their hard-earned money so that we can keep doing it. It's kind of a beacon in dark times. I know that's a cliche, but it's true.
Yeah, it's great if your kind words come attached with a donation, but if they don't, kind words by themselves are great too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't we transition into some news? And John, I understand that you've been busy in Budapest attending events. And so do you want to give us some background on what you've been up to recently?
Sure. Well, yesterday, which is was Saturday, September 2nd, for those of you who are going to be listening a few days from now, Identitas Generatio, which is the Hungarian branch of Generation Identity, had an event up at Buda Castle, which is the historically it was the seat of the Hungarian monarchy, to commemorate the date in 1686 when a combined force of not just Hungarians but also Germans and Croatians and Dutch and Italians and Czechs and French and Danes and Swedes, and I can't even remember who all else was in this army that was assembled, retook Buda from the Ottoman Turks, who had captured it 150 years earlier, approximately. And the Hungarian GI, they've been around for a while now, but they're just now starting to try to do more events to kind of raise their profile with the public. So they arranged this march yesterday, which started at the base of Buda Castle, and we did a complete circuit around it. And there were, appropriately, given that the fact that it was a pan-European army that ousted the Turks, the Hungarians were joined by people from, the Polish, Austrian, Serbian, Czech, Italian, and Slovenian chapters of Generation Identity were all present. They all sent delegations. And there was even one other American guy who showed up, to my surprise. I won't mention his name, not because he asked me not to, but just because I haven't gotten his permission. But yeah, there were really people from everywhere. And it was quite stimulating to march. If you go to the Hungarian IG Facebook page, they have links to some photographs and some video that was taken during the event. And, you know, we marched around the castle, kind of startling some of the tourists and some of the Hungarians who were there. I don't know if they knew exactly what to think, but I think that some of them will certainly be prompted to find out more about what the event was about and what the organization was. We were asked by a few people who approached us to find out what was going on. And it certainly did a lot for the morale of the Hungarian IG itself, which is still new and kind of and growing at the moment. So yeah, I thought it was a really good event overall. We marched for about an hour, and then we came to a spot where there's a plaque commemorating the people who fell in the retaking of Budapest. And there were two speeches. One was in Hungarian, and the other was in English, where they just sort of summarized for everyone who was present what what they were commemorating, and the fact that, you know, kind of outlining the identitarian view that Hungary is under attack again. This time, of course, the enemy isn't just on the outside, but it's on the inside as well, as we have people facilitating the migrant crisis and facilitating an influx of millions of people from the Muslim world and elsewhere. So just kind of, you know, providing a context for the event that although they were commemorating history, of course, this was also a statement about Europe itself, not even just Hungary, but all of Europe. Since if the Hungarians had been defeated by the Turks, obviously, they could have easily just swept over the rest of Europe and into Western Europe as well. So it was a triumph for Europe and not just for Hungary. And that's also how the identitarians see the current crisis with immigration, that it's something that affects, well, not even just Europe, but people of European descent all over the world. You know, we're under attack now, and I think the identitarians are doing a great job waking people up to this threat and also to the need for whites everywhere to band together to combat this problem, and also to base their resistance, you know, not on a negative, but on a positive, which I think is the real genius of the identitarian movement, is that they base it on this concept of reinforcing traditional identity, but also embracing aspects of modern culture. I wouldn't really call them an anti-modernist movement, like traditionalism, for example, even though there are some anti-modern, or maybe we should say alt-modern, elements to identitarianism. But they affirm this idea that, you know, every identity in the world, of course, including all of the various European ethnicities, are valuable. So it's not just an anti, it's not just a negative message that they have, which I think is really something that all of us should be looking at as an example. And afterwards, we went and had a very nice dinner at a restaurant nearby that the Hungarian identitarians paid for. I thought that was very nice of them, so I'd like to thank them for that. And then afterwards, we went and increased our comradeship with all of our everyone who was there by having a few beers at a local pub. So it was really a wonderful day and evening. And, you know, I'm very thankful for the Hungarian identitarians for inviting me and for letting me take part.
It's interesting that they had a pan-European army without a pan-European superstate. How is such a thing possible? Well, it was an alliance, basically, a military alliance. These things come and go in times of crisis. Who organized it? Was it specifically the Hungarian identitarians, and then they invited other people to come join them? Or was it organized by all of these groups together?
No, it was only organized by the Hungarian IG, because they're actually not officially a chapter of Generation Identity yet, of the pan-European identitarian movement, but they're working on that, and they hope that they will be accepted soon. But you know, many groups out of solidarity just sent delegations to kind of help them along. That was quite inspirational in that regard, to see so many people coming together. And we were shouting slogans in Hungarian and German and in English. like Europa, Jugend, Defend Europe, these kinds of things. I have to admit, I don't know what all of the Hungarian ones we were shouting, actually, what they were saying, but I know they were, one was against Merkel.
You got to be careful about shouting slogans you don't understand. I'm just joking. There was a story that cracked me up about John Dewey, who was, of course, a sucker for any liberal or leftist cause. And when he was professor at Columbia in the early part of the 20th century, there was a women's lib demonstration going on. This was before women had the right to vote. So this was a women's suffrage demonstration. And so he saw them marching down the street in New York City. And so he rushed into the demonstration, and somebody handed him a sign, and he went marching down the street to demonstrate his solidarity. And after a while, he noticed people pointing and laughing at him. And finally, he looked at the sign that he was carrying, and it said, "Men can vote. Why can't I?"
Well, he didn't bother to look at it?
No, he didn't bother to look. So you got to be careful shouting those slogans in Hungarian. Who knows what kind of trouble you're getting yourself into?
Well, I trust these guys. I know they wouldn't do anything.
I'm just joking.
Before we move on, I just have one question I think I was curious about. What are the prerequisites to join the pan-European Generation Identitaire movement?
I don't know precisely, but I have an idea. I mean, I think they just want to make sure that the groups that they admit and allow to, you know, officially represent them throughout Europe are reliable, and that they're going to stick to the Generation Identity message, which is, you know, it's not racially based, you know, it's based on ethnicity, and they reject, you know, what they refer to as sort of chauvinistic nationalism and any connection with fascism or national socialism or racial supremacist ideas, they reject all that. So I think they just want to make sure that the people that they admit are reliably, you know, not going to do something that's then going to make the whole organization look bad or, you know, get them off message.
Right. That makes sense. I wish I could have been there myself.
We should have had that in Charlottesville, but that's a whole other that's a whole other discussion.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say I wish I could have been there myself.
Oh, I'm sure they're gonna have many more. They're already last night we were already discussing the one for next year, and I was urging them to do, you know, something similar even before then. So because there's certainly many dates in Hungarian history that you could commemorate in such a way.
Is there going to be a delegation of local identitarians who go to the annual march in Poland? I think it's in November.
I would assume so. I haven't I haven't discussed it with them, but I know there's an event when we were having beer last night. They were telling me there's an event in Austria in 1 or 2 weeks that they're going to send a delegation to the Hungarians. I was actually thinking I might tag along, but we'll see. I don't know. I have to see, you know, how much stuff I have to do, but I might try to go to that. The Austrian ones, I know. I mean, this one was since Hungarian IG, rather, because in the Hungarian reckoning, is still quite new. So I'd say we have maybe 50 people, give or take, out there. But the Austrian ones, you know, they're much more firmly established and they've been around for longer. So I know they get hundreds of people for these things. So that would be something to experience.
Speaking of the Austrian Generation Identitaire, have you heard any updates from Martin Sellner on the Defend Europe mission?
No, I didn't actually end up talking about that with anybody last night, but I'm sure there must be stuff online about it.
I haven't heard lately, so I was just kind of curious if that came up or was discussed or anything.
No, but I was mainly, I mean, there were a lot of people there, and I did talk a little bit with the Austrians, but I ended up talking more with the Poles and the Serbs and the Slovenians. I was disappointed, though, to find out that of all the Slovenian identitarians, only one of them was a Laibach fan.
That's hard to believe.
They all like Žižek, though. That's funny. They're like, oh, yeah, we love it that he's coming out, you know, against mass immigration and this kind of stuff.
Did any of the identitarians ask you about Charlottesville?
Yes. Afterwards, when we were having dinner and when we went to the pub, yeah, a few did. You know, I got the impression that, you know, I mean, that as most of the identitarians who were there were from Eastern Europe, and they really don't know that much about what's, I mean, they don't have a very clear idea of what's happening in the U.S.
Right. Well, this was, international news. It was pretty major.
Oh, yeah. What I was about to say was that, of course, you know, they knew about Charlottesville, which is why they asked me about it, but they didn't really know what to think about the alt-right or Trump or Charlottesville, so they were kind of, you know, asking me for my opinion on it to kind of get a take. But, I mean, they all, of course, everyone knows about the fact that there, you know, the Klan was there and that there were Nazi symbols and so forth. And, of course, as identitarians, they agreed that was bad, since that's, you know, the sort of thing that identitarianism in Europe was created to combat, you know, to kind of overcome. So, you know, I think, you know, maybe what happened with the alt-right in the U.S. is that it kind of, you know, was because of the election, it was kind of forced into the public eye prematurely, and they haven't been able to establish this sort of discipline that the identitarians have in Europe. So, you know, hopefully we can see more of that happening in the U.S. in the coming years.
Yes, well, collectively, in the U.S., the alt-right is just a, you know, collection of groups, whereas identitarianism is a more cohesive, unified under a common organization, or at least organized around common principles that are a little more restrictive, I would say, than, you know, what we have on the alt-right.
Yeah, I think diversity of views is good. So, you know, I'm not saying that's necessarily negative with the alt-right, but at the same time, when you're going to be active in the public eye and you want to enter the political arena, you really have to, I think there should be a group, you know, so that you can have this kind of discipline. I realize it's kind of a long, you know, an easy thing to say. And I don't, I mean, of course, then we argue about, well, you know, who's going to run it, who's going to get to decide what its parameters are and so forth. But I don't know. I think somebody needs to start thinking about that.
Right. Because otherwise you can get tied to, you know, whoever the most extreme, most radical, you know, individual that calls yourself alt-right or identitarian or, you know, whatever member, whatever group you're a member of. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, that's all I have to ask about that. Do you have anything else, Greg?
No, I would love to get a identitarian critique of Charlottesville. I sort of imagine what the identitarian critique would be, and I've said that a number of times. But it would actually be interesting to get their considered judgment on this. Maybe I should ask around and see if there's an identitarian writer who would like to share some thoughts on it.
Well, I do have to say in the conversations I had last night, generally people were pretty negative on the alt-right. And even some of the identitarians like said to me, like, oh, I'm not alt-right. Because, you know, they don't like the racialist approach of the U.S. movement, because, you know, the identitarian movement is more based on ethnicity than it is on race. In fact, I don't think they discuss race at all. And also, you know, just having to do with the fact that some segments of the alt-right are, you know, still very openly promoting things related to National Socialism and so forth. So I know, you know, I did hear some criticism last night from some people of that.
Yeah, well, of course, European ethnicity or the ethnicity of any European group implies membership and being part of the white race. So.
Yeah, but you never hear Europeans discuss it in those terms. You know, I very rarely hear, you know, anybody who's active on the right in Europe refer to themselves as white. I mean, you know, they think of themselves as Hungarians and Poles and Slovenes and so forth. And I mean, I think this is just an issue of semantics between the U.S. and Europe. Because obviously, I mean, in one of the great things about identitarianism in Europe is that it's designed to overcome all these various national and regional chauvinisms and conflicts that have been weakening Europe for centuries. I mean, they do, you know, favor this idea of a pan-European identity alongside the idea of your national or regional identity. So, you know, they're already laying the foundations for something akin to white nationalism in the U.S. They just call it something else. And I think, you know, that's the right way for them to go as Europeans.
Right. Certainly, you know, when you see non-Europeans insert themselves into the native European societies, that is definitely something which Europeans can, European nationalists can identify as much of, as being foreign as when it happens in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But you know, we have different cultural and historical contexts. And, you know, I mean, obviously I was there and I was welcomed. So, I mean, myself as a white American, you know, they see me as a brother. You know, it's not like there's some kind of, you know, like, well, this is only for Europeans or something like that. I mean, you know, I would say they have sort of a white nationalist consciousness. They just don't think of it in those terms.
It's weird. Is there just a taboo on talking about race? Because if it's just a taboo, you'd like to see these people get over that eventually.
Well,
right?
I just, when I talk to most European nationalists, they just don't see it as important. I mean, it makes sense in the U.S. because, you know, we've been a multiracial society for so long. But, you know, in Europe, too, you know, I mean, people, they don't want to think of Poles and as the English and Germans and you know, so forth as all being the same. So, you know, they want to emphasize ethnicity, you know, for an obvious reason. Because, you know, even though Germans and Austrians are racially the same, there's obviously still significant ethnic differences there. And even within Germany, you know, you have Bavarians and so forth. And I can understand why they want to preserve these things. But I've never really seen that as a problem of theirs. I mean, they basically have the same viewpoint that we do. I mean, I've never actually heard an identitarian say, we don't care about race or reject race. They just, they don't seem to think of it as something that's particularly relevant for what they're doing. But I don't know. Maybe we should have one of them on and we can ask them about this.
Yeah, I was just thinking that myself. Yeah. Instead of speculating about what they think, we should just have a conversation with one of these people. So yeah, let's add that to our agenda for future podcasts. Then I'm going to make note of that.
In my defense, I'll just say that a number of them came up to me yesterday and had read that article, "What Is Identitarianism?" that I published at Countercurrents a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were really thanking me. In fact, I think it was one of the Serbian guys actually told me he thought it was the best individual piece on explaining what identitarianism is that he's read. So I was quite flattered. So yeah, maybe people should go and read my article on that if they haven't already. But yeah, we should still have maybe one of the French or Austrian identitarians on at some point.
Yeah, I think that would be most interesting. One thing I want to do is segue now to a book that I've read recently. And this, I think, is a harbinger of things to come from the left. It's a book by Mark Lilla. It's called The Once and Future Liberal: After Identity Politics. It just came out from Harper. Now, Mark Lilla is somebody that I have been following since 1994, believe it or not, when he published his book on Vico, G.B. Vico, The Making of an Anti-Modern, is the subtitle, G.B. Vico, The Making of an Anti-Modern. And I thought it was a really quite good book on Vico as an anti-modernist thinker. And since then, he's published a number of other books. He's published a book called The Stillborn God, and he's published a couple of collections of essays. He's written a lot for the New York Review of Books and put together some of these sort of middlebrow and New York Review of Books essays in collections, one called The Reckless Mind, Tut-Tutting, Intellectuals About Getting Involved with Radical Politics, and another called The Shipwrecked Mind, About Political Reaction. And basically, the way I read Lilla is that he is a Straussian of some kind, of some sort. But unlike most of the Straussians, who are liberals at heart, but pretend to be conservatives, he just is an open liberal. He's a professor of humanities at Columbia University, and he lives in Brooklyn. And he's a very clear writer, an engaging writer. I think this new book is, intellectually speaking, stimulating, but it's really a failure, because what he's trying to do is he's trying to pull back from the abyss of identity politics. And it's specifically addressed to the left, to liberals, to New York Review of Books type Manhattan liberals, basically, and Beltway liberals, the liberal elites. And it's a warning against identity politics, because he thinks that identity politics is going to be a losing game for the Democratic Party. And I see this as part of a reaction that is establishment-wide against identity politics. We have the same essential arguments being given by Republicans, conservative types, against right-wing identity politics. The whole alt-light is now simply a barrier against people going into white identity politics. That seems to be its entire purpose for being now, is simply to hold the line against white identity politics. And the Lilla book is an attempt to argue against identity politics from a democratic liberal point of view. And basically the reason he wants to make this argument is he thinks it's a losing proposition. And I have to say that I think he's probably right about this. And the tendency has been, of course, we all know this, the tendency for the left has been to go, since really the 1960s, towards identity politics, political correctness, minority uplift, the creation of new minorities, the creation of new identity groups, all of which have long lists of grievances and need to be recognized. You know, adding every year or so a new letter to the LGBTQ YRXZ, list, for instance. It's an inherently factionalizing, fragmenting dialectic that the left is undergoing right now. And basically, it all comes attached to highly emotional demands for inclusion and social mobility, social uplift for groups that claim to be marginalized. And oftentimes these quote-unquote marginalized people are just really the offspring of wealth and privilege, the ruling caste who have mental problems, mental health issues, and feel alienated and are demanding recognition because they belong to new victim groups. And you get really sick phenomena like people like this crazy woman who wanted to be disabled, so she blinded herself with the help of a psychiatrist who, as far as I know, has not been thrown in jail or thrown out of the medical profession. There's a sick dialectic that you attain status by being marginal and an outcast. And, of course, the dirty secret is that there's nothing more establishment than this whole dynamic of pretending to be an aggrieved outcast and being marginalized. So anyway, it's a bad look for the Democrats at this point, though, because first of all, it spawned a reaction from the largest, most powerful group in the country in terms of numbers and in terms of net wealth, too, which is the white majority. White identity politics is afoot. And if white identity politics snowballs and becomes really militant, it will steamroll all the other minority identity politics together or separately. It'll steamroll them. And so they're really worried about this. And I think they're also just worried about the fact that the Democratic Party now is the party of transsexuals and Black Lives Matter, these angry, hateful blacks in the streets. It's the party of Antifa. It's the party of masked thugs beating up old people and throwing balloons full of urine at people carrying American flags. And the fact that Nancy Pelosi, of all people, has come out attacking, denouncing Antifa is very, very interesting. And first of all, the people who say that the left, people on the left, never punch left, take note of this. They do punch left, right? People who are more moderate will disavow people who are more extreme than them. And people think, well, maybe this is based on principle. Chances are it's just based on poll data. But the Democrats are looking at poll data and they're seeing that left identity politics is very bad for them. And the 2018 midterm election has a whole lot of disadvantages baked into it for the Democrats. They will likely lose seats in the next election, and the Republicans will become more powerful. And they are facing the abyss right now. And I think one of the things that's going on in their heads is they're recognizing this, and they're recognizing that these Antifa thugs, Black Lives Matter, and all this other stuff is a bad look for them. And so they're trying to pull back from this, and they're trying to retrench with a more inclusive, liberal uplift message. And this is what the Mark Alillo book is basically all about. He's saying, let's get away from this factionalized, hyper-emotional identity politics and stress what he calls the New Deal dispensation, the Roosevelt dispensation of inclusion, government intervention, and uplift for the whole society, rather than basically left identity politics, which he says is just the flip side of Reaganism. And I thought this was the most interesting argument of the book. He says, look, the post-Reagan era on the right has been it's been anti-political. It's been about it being against government. It's been about private life, the private sector, privatization, a withdrawal from the political, from any notion of a common political realm, a common good, or anything like that. And he says that left identity politics has a similar dynamic to it. It's anti-political in a strong sense. It's selfish. It's subjectivist, And therefore, it's ineffective as a form of politics. And he thinks that the only way to fight right identity politics, which he knows is feeding into the Trump phenomenon, is to drop the left identity politics and to focus on, again, the Roosevelt dispensation, this liberal universalist vision that we're all about fairness and inclusion for everyone. Now, the thing that I find very dubious about the whole book is the idea that this will ever happen. Basically, what this book is written for is it's written for white liberals. And it's basically saying that white liberals need to take control of the Democratic Party and they need to shut up Black Lives Matter, shut up the trannies, shut up the people on the college campuses, and appeal to white voters again. Now, I just don't think that's going to happen because they've already lost control of their party. They've already lost control of the zeitgeist at the left. This is an attempt at pushing that back, but I think it's too little too late. I do not think that the Democratic Party is ever going to be ruled and dictated to by white liberals like Mark Lilla again. And so I think it's sort of a failure. The other thing that I think he doesn't realize, or maybe he's just, concealing this, is that this universalistic liberalism is the identity politics of a certain white group, namely white liberals. This is their identity politics. It is not a universal form of political philosophy. It is not something that makes sense to people who come from Africa and Asia and south of the border. They're not here to take part in some grand liberal experiment. They're here to get stuff from white people. And that's how they look at these things. And so the paradox is that liberalism is leading to its own destruction, because basically what liberalism in Lilla's sense is a vision of, it's a kind of imperialism, a kind of cultural imperialism that imagines that all the people of the world really want to be like New York liberals, New England liberals. And if we're just open enough to them and inclusive enough and welcoming enough, they will be transformed into people like us. And that hasn't worked for a long time. And what they're doing, though, is by being inclusive and being open and bringing these people in and practicing affirmative action and so forth, they have now lost control of their own institutions. And I don't think they're really going to regain control over these institutions. And the great question that we're going to face is whether whites as a whole will ever regain control over our societies. I think the Democratic Party is lost at this point. Is America lost? That's the real question. So anyway, I thought Lilla's book was interesting. There's a new piece out by, I think, a South Asian writer. I just saw it today on Salon.com, echoing a lot of the same arguments. Identity politics is a bad thing for the left. We need to get rid of it. We need to be universalistic. But this universalism doesn't appeal to all the non-white constituency groups that they have brought in to overthrow the white majority. It just doesn't appeal to them. And they now have the power to get their way and dictate the future of the party. And again, the only question is, will they have the power to dictate the future of America? Will we ever be able to take our country back? That's the great question. I think liberalism is done in Mark Lilla's sense. I think, that you need to stick a fork in it. The only question is America done? They will never make the Democratic Party great again, but we might make America great again.
Well, I think we saw with Bernie Sanders the reason why he was so successful was because he had a message that actually resonated with a lot of white voters who, perhaps didn't resonate with Hillary because he was actually attempting to answer the concerns of working class Americans, which is, of course, the same thing that Donald Trump tapped into. But the Democratic Party reacted with horror. And, I knew some of my leftist friends back in the U.S. were Bernie supporters, but some of them were like, he's so old-fashioned and, that'll never work. And, you know, they basically bought the Democratic Party's line that, you know, anything other than doubling down on this Hillary-style SJW rhetoric was the way forward for the party. So yeah, I don't see how there's any possibility of that changing for them.
Yeah, I think once you've stirred the pot of the aggrieved and you have an underclass, it's kind of with the expectation that they're going to be taken care of by the state, that they're going to be granted benefits, and you know, that they are, it's okay for them to organize under the banner of Black Lives Matter or, you know, other identity groups, the Dreamers, or, you know, anything else. You can't really walk that back because these groups are out there, and it's not going to be like, you know, you have both parties just kind of saying no, and they're going to go off and, you know, create their own kind of third coalition. You know, I think the Bernie Sanders was kind of the Democratic Party's last best shot, you know, at really kind of reasserting itself. And, you know, Bernie's taking things in a, you know, more socialist direction than, I think the Democratic Party has been in a long time.
Right. The Democratic Party of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton is basically left-wing multicultural oligarchy, right? Whereas, you know, it's a multiracial oligarchy model. It's the left-wing, yes, oligarchy model that was discussed by Jonathan Bowden. Now, what Sanders really is talking about is old-fashioned social democracy, which has basically just been dropped by the Clinton machine. That approach, and really, it's been dropped by all the center left parties. Now, the thing that's funny and ironic about Bernie Sanders is that although he's Jewish, what he's really arguing for in America is a kind of white identity politics. Basically, he's arguing for the politics that exists in Scandinavian welfare states. The trouble is that we don't have a Scandinavian population in America. And the Scandinavians are increasingly not having a Scandinavian population, and that's not going to bode well for their welfare states either. But what's gone on, and one of the things that's happened, and I've talked to certain Bernie bros and Bernie sisses since the election, some of them have realized that basically what the reason that Bernie Sanders lost was that black people wouldn't vote for him. They were voting for Hillary and Gibbs, and they're just selfish and small-minded. And they came to realize that what they want is the kind of thing that can only exist in a majority white society and can only triumph in a party that's run by white liberals. And so they've come to wake up to the fact that they actually are advocates of white identity politics of the left-wing variety, which I think is valuable. I think that's incredibly important that people are waking up to that, and I would like to see more former Bernie Sanders supporters wake up to this fact. That's really, really important, because our aim, again, is not just to have a right-wing sectarian white identity politics, but to have a hegemonic identity white identity politics that embraces the entire political spectrum. That's how we win. So I think that is very heartening that that's happened. But yes, I mean, if you just look at the last election, if you look at the last primaries in the Democratic Party, you basically see the battle. And that battle shows that the forces that are most like Mark Lilla, namely Bernie Sanders and the kinds of people that Bernie Sanders was appealing to, namely white idealistic universalistic liberals, doesn't have the power to get their people nominated. And if they don't have the power to get their people nominated, they're never going to get elected. And that really does spell, I think, long-term defeat for the civic nationalist, universalist left politics that Mark Lilla is trying to revive. I think it's just too late for that. It's too late for that. And, you know, I don't mourn the passage of this because these people brought it on themselves. Now, if white nationalism succeeds and we have white ethnostates again, there will be a place for people like Mark Lilla. But let's hope that they or their or his that people like Lilla in the future are chastened by the experience and realize that their universalism isn't universal, that it's a projection of their own specifically white European mentality, and that they're not going to try and pull the same shenanigans again, basically importing non-white groups and treating them as a coalition to get their policies. I had this conversation years ago with this San Francisco liberal Democrat that I knew. Very nice lady, a very sincere person. But she explained to me what the Democratic strategy was. And I basically said, so, okay, so let me get this straight. Your strategy is to fill the country with people who are from Latin America and who are Muslims and who are Africans and who are Asians. None of these places support gay rights, women's rights, the arts, abortion rights, and things like that, which you support. And you think that once you have enough of these people in the country and the Democratic Party runs everything, that they're just going to sit back and let you impose abortion rights and women's rights and arts funding and stuff like that instead of actually asserting their values. And you could just see the look of horror start coming over her face as she realized, yes, this is the abyss. This is the abyss that they're staring into, because the whole assumption of Democratic Party politics is that that democracy will never happen and that the new majority will not actually dictate its values, that a white liberal minority will continue to dictate all the values to this new majority that they're creating. And that's just not going to happen. It'll never happen. And it's already ceasing to happen. It ceased to happen in the last election cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's I can't think of anything to disagree with in that. I think that is the flaw in, I do believe there really are people who are disingenuous about what they think the outcome of all this multi-culti ideology will be, but psychotically want to destroy Western civilization.
Well, there are enough of them tweeting about it every day that yes, there are definitely people who want to do us harm. It's not just some ghastly mistake that they're making that we can talk them out of. They definitely are up to no good. But there are a lot of people who are just naive and have blundered into this thinking it's a great idea and that somehow these people are all going to be like them anyway because everybody's basically a white liberal at heart, right? So I think that those people are becoming fewer in the Democratic Party, and I think some of these people might be waking up to race and identity politics and moving in our direction. Let's hope that they do.
We see that Britain's kind of already gone, it's far more advanced down that path of trying to pursuing the delusion, thinking, allowing, Pakistanis into the left wing parties and, thinking that they're going to continue supporting the left as they grow in size and influence, that, are going to continue to have Sadiq Khan's, be representative of this minority population, rather than, pro-ISIS jihadist. Every new terror attack that we see happening in the cities of the UK or France is a counterpoint to that.
Yeah, I think that they're especially ill-suited to deal with Muslims because Muslims just outright practice lying, taqiyya, and they don't feel any qualms about it. It's part of their culture and it's part of their religion. And they are from low trust tribal societies, and their religion is a manifestation of that mentality, a sanctification of that mentality. And so it's child's play for these people to come into high trust European societies where people want to welcome you and include you, thinking that you can become part of an enlarged community. Whereas these people know how to mimic that rhetoric and use that rhetoric. And then, of course, they also use the rhetoric of posing hate and bigotry against any kind of white resistance. But really, they're just out for their own tribal ethnic advancement. And they simply have an advantage. There's a systematic game theoretical advantage that you have if you are playing a group strategy against people who are playing by an individualist strategy. And it doesn't take a vast number of these people to overthrow the ruling elites of a society and take it over if they burrow their way in and worm their way to the top. And we've seen that model again and again and again. And it's playing itself out in every white society that basically invites these tribal dual loyalty, dual ethics type people into it and don't realize that the only way that they can preserve a high trust European society is by excluding people who hack that ethos and basically use it to hollow out society and colonize it with these parasitic tribes.
I forget who it was, but there was some guy who'd been a Labour MP in England in the early 1970s, and I was told that he wrote an autobiography that was published a few years ago in which he actually openly admitted that when he was pushing for more immigration in England, that he didn't care anything about the immigrants at all, but that he just saw it as a weapon to be used, you know, against traditional Britain. I wish I could remember his name, but it's not coming to me off the top of my head.
Oh, well, that's well known now. I mean, there have been documents and, you know, leaks and things like that from a number of people that the New Labour policy was simply to displace, to create a permanent left ruling coalition by displacing white Britons with non-whites. I mean, it's not a secret anymore. It's now known to everyone.
Yeah, I remember Tony Blair made some remarks to that effect. It got leaked. In the late 90s.
I think it was in the early 2000s. But yeah, it's out there. It's known. So anyway, I want to segue to our little shop talk portion, and I just want to use it to promote something that I've been working on for a while. And that is North American New Right, Volume 2. People have been wondering where this is. The first North American New Right volume came out in 2012. And at the time, I was thinking I'd put these things out yearly, but obviously it hasn't worked out that way. So what was going on with the North American New Right idea? Well, I just came to realize that we don't need another print journal. And people weren't all that interested in it. The greatest impact that Countercurrents has is by putting articles online, not by putting articles in a journal-type format. And so, naturally, it just got sort of shoved to the back burner. And honestly, I would just forget about it for long stretches of time. But I do have this volume. Basically, the table of contents has been sitting ready since 2014, believe it or not. And I've decided with a few small changes, I'm going to bring it out this fall. And it'll probably be the last volume in the series. I think it was an experiment. It was an experiment that I'm going to close with this second volume. It's going to look beautiful, by the way. The cover design, the cover art is gorgeous. Everyone's going to want to have a copy of it. And I'm going to run through the table of contents and just give you guys an idea of what's coming. So North American New Right Volume 2 is going to contain articles by Aidan Cassiel, Ricardo Duchesne, it's a piece on the Enlightenment from a New Right perspective. My essay, Leo Strauss, The Conservative Revolution and National Socialism, will be in there. Donald Thorson's White Nationalist Answers to Post-Colonialist Questions will be there. Mark Dial's We Are the Real Subalterns, Deleuze, Guattari, and the New Right. A piece by Simon Lote called Selection by Lot and White Nationalism. A piece by Andrew Hamilton on race in the films of D.W. Griffith. There will be Christopher Pankhurst's essay, God Has Become Cancer, Damien Hirst, Religion and Death, which is one of my favorite pieces by him. John Morgan, you have a piece on Colin Wilson that was originally written as an obituary, but you've rewritten that now, I understand.
Yeah, it's still parts of it are still the same, but I fleshed parts of it out and expanded it. So I think even people who read the original are gonna find it interesting because I've put in everything I could discover about Colin's political views in there.
Oh, that's great.
So people should find that interesting.
Good. Good. There are some extensive review essays and reviews. The Colin Cleary's huge review essay on Ricardo Duchesne's The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. That is such a big piece that it really needs to be read on the printed page and digested. Jeff Costello's review of Jack Donovan's The Way of Men is another very long and heavy an important piece that really needs to be read on the printed page. I have a piece, The Political Soldier, on Carl Schmitt's Theory of the Partisan. Gregory Hood's essay, The Rising, on the Revolutionary Lessons of Michael Collins, both the man and the movie, is also included. Derek Hawthorne's essay on Opfergang, Masterpiece of National Socialist Cinema, is included. Roger Devlin has a couple of reviews, one on Alain de Benoist's The Problem of Democracy and another on Benoist's autobiography. And then finally, there is Kevin MacDonald on my book, New Right versus Old Right, rounding it out. So it's a volume of about 400 and some odd pages with gorgeous cover art. I think it's going to look fantastic when it's done. And when I probably get copies of it in the mail, I'm going to take it out of the box and be so delighted with it, I'll think, well, maybe we should do another volume in the future. But anyway, the current plan is to make this the last one, but we'll see. I might feel a great deal of pride once it appears and think, you know, the world needs more things like this.
Well, maybe it could be like Tear, you know, where yeah. It only comes out every five years. So often, but yeah. It's always an event when it happens.
Yeah, exactly. So I might do something like that because we do publish some long, heavy, detailed pieces that sometimes really do need to be put on the printed page. And if they're not going to go into an anthology by that particular author, they need some place to go. And so that's sort of how I conceived of North America New Right. And there will definitely be a place for these there will be a need for pieces like this, a place for pieces like this in the future.
I think it's good to have a forum for the shorter stuff because, you know, you either have stuff that goes online and then, you know, disappears and nobody ever gets to see it again or, you know, book length stuff. So it's, mm-hmm. It's good, I think, to have a place for the shorter things, but it's also a lot of work. So
yeah.
Maybe when we have a bigger staff.
Exactly. We'll continue to do that. Yeah. Well, John, Mike, do you want to add anything before we wrap up? We've been going at this for about an hour now.
I'll just quickly mention this band. Well, it's really one guy, although he's sort of a one-man band that I only recently became aware of. But Matt Hoden is his name, performed on Friday here in Budapest. The band is Zeben, and it's a neo-folk project. And I've never heard or seen anything quite like it. He's quite charming, you know, a typical English wit about him, you know, very pleasant demeanor and personality. He plays the violin and sings, but what he does is he has this elaborate setup where he'll play a bit or sing something or say something, and he records it and then plays it back on a loop on this machine that he has, and he keeps adding more and more layers until after a few minutes, you know, he's got this like complex, you know, almost like symphony going. And I was really impressed, and he's obviously very passionate about the music. I mean, he seemed, you know, almost like in a shamanic trance or something at times. And I didn't get the feeling that he was it was an act, like you see with some musicians who try to show the world how profound their being or whatever. I mean, I actually got the feeling from him that he was really intimately involved in the music he was creating and sort of, you know, wandering around the stage and kind of in ecstasy or something. And it was really something to see. So if people who don't know that band, I'd recommend that they check them out.
Mike, do you want to toss out anything?
I can't really think of anything to add.
Well, thank you for all the work you've been doing with the migration to the new web hosting platform. I know you've been pretty wiped out after all the stress and long hours, but it seems to have taken hold. So, you know, we really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, I want to mention one thing before I go. Last night I watched a movie that I highly recommend. And first of all, I spent some time with Jared Taylor recently. And one of the things that I was delighted to learn is that Jared Taylor is an anime enthusiast. Having been born in Japan and raised in Japan and speaking fluent Japanese and having a couple of daughters, he's had occasion to watch anime and actually likes it. And so he recommended a movie to me called The Grave of the Fireflies, which came out, I think, in 1988. And so I watched it. It's 84 minutes long, basically. And it's an astonishing film. It's a cartoon. It's about two children who were orphaned by the fire bombings of Tokyo in the Second World War. And it's just beautifully done. It's incredibly sad and moving. And terrifying in places. It's a very serious cartoon about a very terrible time in history, and it's done without rancor, as Jared put it to me. The airplanes, the bombs are like a force of nature, right? We know that they're Americans and everything like that, but they just sort of come and they rain down destruction and they leave. And then these children have to deal with the consequences. And it's an incredibly powerful and touching film and so beautifully made. I'm going to actually write a review of it this coming week if I can spare the time. But it's called The Grave of the Fireflies. And basically, in terms of its art, it's what I was hoping I would find from Japanese animation. It reminds me of these wonderful artists from the 19th and 18th centuries, people like Hokusai, the great printmaker, brought to life just beautiful lines, beautiful contrasts between very carefully delineated sort of cartoon-like images and then backgrounds that are sort of watercoloristic and misty. It's just incredibly beautiful visually, and the music is very beautiful too. So The Grave of the Fireflies is definitely something I recommend.
Yeah, I've never had any prejudice against anime like some people do, but the problem is, like everything else, you never know. There's so much of it, you don't know which is the good stuff.
Well, so far, this seems really, really good, but I have to say I've only watched two movies like this, so I don't have any broad basis to choose from. But Jared highly recommended it, and it turns out to be truly magnificent. So, yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. Whether you if you like this kind of movies, or if you're skeptical of these kind of movies, either way, it's definitely worth seeing. It's good as a movie. It's not just good anime. It's good as a movie in the absolute sense. And it's definitely not for kids, even though it's about kids. It's not for kids. It's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, you should post a link.
Yeah, I'll post a link in the show notes. Well, guys, thank you so much for this. I appreciate everything you've been doing in our recent crisis, which seems to be dying down for now, knock on wood.
Yeah.
There's always this sort of a cliche in movies where as soon as somebody says, no force on earth can stop us now, you know, something terrible happens. So I have to resist my my tendency to say things like that, but things seem to be okay now. We've gone through the first wave of deplatformings, and let's hope that the next wave doesn't hit us. Other people are taking a real beating, like the Daily Stormer, though, and I don't think that's going to let up for a long time. So anyway, we're going to still be here, and we're going to be back to normal by the end of this week. So thank you, Mike and John, and thank you all, our listeners and supporters out there, and we'll be back very soon with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
See you next time, everybody. Thanks.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you soon.